Hey everyone, welcome back to the forum where we socialize with you and you socialize with science. I'm Aubrey, and with me today are my science world socialites, Daniela and Cleo.
As much as I love the idea of being referred to as that, I think it may be a stretch to call ourselves science world socialites.
Agreed. Thanks for the intro, Aubrey, but I think we might be talking ourselves up again. Anyway, if you at home want to join the conversation with us socialites, be sure to tweet us your questions, comments, and opinions with @ISGBForum and the hashtag ISGBForum. And you'll find our show on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGBForum.
Okay, so now that we're all back from vacation, let's get started on this week's episode.
Wait, what vacation? I don't recall taking any vacation.
You know I just got back from the beach, Dee. Remember I sent you the pictures of the beautiful sunsets and pina coladas?
Yeah, Aubrey, but I'm pretty sure that was just you, as Cleo and I watched enviously.
Oh well, oops. Although it was a great time, there were some downsides. I couldn't get myself to stop thinking about what will happen in the next few years to the beach house we usually rent.
And that's a totally legitimate concern, one that actually brings us right into today's episode topic. Today's podcast will discuss a debate that occurred at one of ISGP's Climate Change Program conferences, which was held in October 2015 in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Sea Level Rise, What's Our Next Move, was the name of the conference.
And the paper in question, titled Adapting to Sea Level Rise, The Tension Between Protection and Discontinuous Change, was written by Dr. Andy Keeler, who is the program head for public policy at the University of North Carolina Coastal Studies Institute and a professor of economics at East Carolina University.
So, sea level rise adaptation. So I guess we'll be talking about building protection around our beaches and such, right? Or actually, what does discontinuous change even mean?
Discontinuous change means to actually stop living in a certain community in preparation for the population to eventually move away.
Wait, you mean relocation? Is that really necessary?
Well, predictions about necessary responses and preventive measures do vary, but nonetheless, significant sea level rise is expected to happen over the next 50 to 250 years, intensifying the risk of coastal living and rendering certain locations uninhabitable.
Even if greenhouse gas emissions were to stop immediately, ice sheets will continue to melt well into the future because of the heat currently stored in the oceans.
So that means that the transitional wetlands of many estuarine shorelines will disappear completely.
Right. So although most communities have yet to act, changing climate conditions are making inaction an unrealistic and, quite frankly, naive option.
All right. So what kind of action can we take?
Well, in responding to this inevitable rise in sea level, communities typically undertake three strategies. First, doing nothing. Second, protecting coastal developments and shorelines.
And third, moving away from the affected areas. Sea level rise adaptation means finding a proper balance of when to prioritize which of the three strategies. Sometimes, sea level rise adaptation can actually have unwanted consequences.
Really? What do you mean?
Well, for example, protecting our coastal properties can actually incentivize increased development on risky shorelines. In other words, when we invest in our coastline infrastructure, we're making an economic commitment to it, meaning we're planning to remain there for the long run.
And that's not a good thing? Shouldn't we be planning for the long run?
Well, yes and no. We should be planning for the long run, as sea levels will inevitably rise. But planning for the long run is not necessarily only done by investing in making our establishments more resilient. Much uncertainty remains, but some low-lying coasts may eventually become too risky to live in, if not completely uninhabitable. So, Dr. Keeler argues that communities must begin to think about relocation. By investing in stronger buildings and foundations, we of course protect communities now, but also attract new residents via development and construction of big properties that may not exist for very long.
Okay. I see where you're going with this. But wait, as much as I understand that, we do still need to protect our coasts in the meantime. At least, I don't see how we can't.
Yeah, and we will. Protection strategies are likely to be used until the costs of protective investments outweigh the benefits.
Let's say when the cost of importing sand outweighs the economic value of beach replenishment, for instance.
Right. And it's at this point that affected areas will finally be vacated, but probably not before. which is unfortunate considering a shift to proactive approaches is needed in order to refrain from continuous unproductive disaster relief.
Yeah, unproductive. Or just plain dangerous. I think everyone can agree that a gradual non-emergency relocation is preferable to a sudden relocation caused by a disaster. Dr. Keeler urged policymakers to begin considering relocation as a viable option and to include it in planning strategies to encourage population movement away from the shore. This could be done through zoning laws, for example.
True, and these approaches need to consider both long and short-term strategies, but the issue is that our current policies and incentives don't support such a shift. Actually, they safeguard the attraction of living on the shore.
Safeguard? Really? How so? I mean, beyond the fact that I turn on my TV and am bombarded with advertisements to do AC, Aubrey, tell your state to stop being reckless, okay?
All right, will do, Cleo. But it's true, Daniela makes a good point. Debaters attributed this safeguarding to the fact that owners of high-value coastal properties are insulated from the true costs of risk by insurance subsidies, local and federal incentives, taxpayer-funded shore protection measures, and even post-disaster relief.
And some wealthy and commercial coastal property owners even find it more economical to opt out of paying for wind and flood insurance altogether and to take a financial loss, which may be tax-deductible in a disaster.
Exactly. Debaters agreed that while government aid through programs like the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, needs to continue providing post-disaster relief, this money and effort should not support new projects, such as floodproofing and assistance with rebuilding, that encourage living in risky areas.
So, should government continue providing coastal services that aid property owners and real estate investors? Because if I'm understanding this correctly, then it actually incentivizes private investment in at-risk areas, and at taxpayer expense.
Actually, Cleo, debaters had that same question. Real estate and local businesses are considered driving forces for community change. Dr. Keeler argues that they should be expected to have a strong voice in determining implementation of adaptive strategies instead of accepting subsidies to hide costs.
And debaters didn't seem to disagree. Although they acknowledged that real estate transactions already have risk disclosure requirements, they also urged that sea level rise and storm surge information needs to be included. Not only did they suggest including risk information, they also argued that property owners need to be required to formally sign that they understand the ramifications of building or living on vulnerable coastal property.
Right, but risks do not only apply to physical harm of flooding and natural disasters, but the current policy structure hurts local economies as well. Hidden property subsidies are actually economically challenging for communities and states as tax revenue is used to subsidize property damage to benefit wealthy property owners rather than for other public goods. Changes are needed that either raise additional funds or transfer financial responsibility to coastal property owners.
So how can we change these policies in order to shift incentives and reflect the hidden costs? When would be a good time to push for this paradigm shift?
How about now?
Well, debaters agreed that a key time for encouraging policymakers to consider a shift in priorities is immediately following storm and flood events resulting from natural disasters.
Sounds smart. I mean, use the fear and panic to society's advantage, right? Get something good out of a bad situation.
Guys, we do have mitigation and adaptation strategies that currently exist, primarily at the national level, though.
That is true, but actually these strategies are often not implemented because of a variety of roadblocks, such as lack of funds, lack of political support, and political corruption.
You do have a point. The 2-year and 4-year election cycles are not very helpful in changing the willingness of elected officials to make long-term decisions.
Yeah, and while debaters agreed that that's a valid point, they also acknowledged that the larger problem continues to be the inability of society to decide what to embrace or reject in terms of strategy and technology.
You mean, like when I'm trying to be environmentally friendly and can't decide between buying boxed water or a new permanent water bottle? Ooh, or when I bike all the way to work instead of driving, but I'm still using an electric bike, so I can't decide if supporting these batteries is actually helping the environment or not.
Calm down, Dee. Although those are all good, I'm pretty sure the debaters were actually referring to a little bit of a larger scale.
Right. Like when coastal communities recognize that valid studies state that they'll have to migrate in a set number of years, so they begin investing in protective barriers for rising seas and flooding, but simultaneously try to begin developing plans for relocation.
And this isn't a problem just in the US. Actually, the inability of societies to effectively embrace adaptive strategies is a reoccurring issue worldwide.
That's true. And although national policies to reduce greenhouse gases, burn fewer fossil fuels, and reduce deforestation are needed, enacting these policies proves to be extremely difficult. This is mostly due to the reluctance of nations to be the first to act without the assurance that other nations will follow suit.
Okay, but although the scale of need at the international level goes way beyond what individual citizens can address, within the United States, resources are available to address the problem of coastal sea level rise domestically, and to develop and test relocation strategies and adaptive technologies.
Yeah, including technologies for managing disease outbreaks in warming climates, building mobile shelters, and protecting coastlines.
But beyond these developments benefiting vulnerable American coastal communities, they can also provide valuable assistance internationally by sharing technology and information.
Actually, that reminds me that debaters mentioned the U.S.'s role in the international response. They agree that since sea level rise is an international challenge, it's the responsibility of wealthy nations like the U.S. to lead the way in the development of mitigation and adaptation strategies, and to ensure that communities in need are connected with the proper technologies and resources to adopt the strategies.
Even if technology is readily accessible and shared, scientists first need to confront the challenge of educating communities concerning the necessity of immediate planning despite the uncertain rate of sea level rise.
Well, then it's only natural that post-disaster measures need to be reformed in order to enable citizens to make better adaptive decisions for both the short and long term.
Right. Debaters recognize that planning requires identifying which key buildings in a vulnerable area should be maintained and for how long.
They urge that as scientists, engineers, and technologists pursue the innovative instruments needed to proactively respond to sea level rise, they also need to address public concerns over the validity of climate change predictions and the need for these strategies. These concerns create public hesitation to support climate adaptation policies, and public reluctance to use new technologies directly affects their individual lifestyles.
That's why Dr. Keeler argued that scientists can actually help communities understand data to decide when to prioritize the protection of individual private properties and key infrastructure, as well as in identifying indicators that signal the need to relocate populations away from the coast.
And if those indicators do come and communities do need to be relocated, debaters found it necessary to ensure equitable relocation, as well as compensation for and prevention of the loss of cultural and social capital, especially for disadvantaged communities.
Economically disadvantaged communities tend to be more heavily impacted by environmental disasters than wealthier citizens.
Right, because coastal communities face rising costs of rebuilding after each disaster and rising costs of insurance as disasters happen more frequently. Low-income communities don't necessarily have the funds to afford such expensive reoccurrences, and thus the costs are not hidden for them.
And on top of that, they're even more vulnerable, because when these costs become too much and they have to relocate, they must then bear the cost of moving to a whole new location.
Meaning, they have to establish themselves with no shelter and search for a new job.
That's why debaters argued that a system is needed to distribute compensation to displaced low-income citizens, maybe through nonprofit social service agencies. But if such agencies are to play a larger role in compensation efforts, they need to be included in planning discussions sooner rather than later.
Right, but compensation and consideration must look out for not only relocating communities, but also those welcoming migrants. As populations leave coastlines, demand will increase for inland acreage, meaning migration will raise the price of inland real estate, and new residents may raise property values.
And to avoid losing residents and tax revenue, debaters suggested that policymakers create a transitional economy that strengthens key infrastructure, connecting job centers and limited residential structures for the influx of new residents through public transportation.
It was urged that communities should create plans that identify specific actions that are triggered by specific observed increases in sea level rise over time. Mitigating and adapting to sea level rise will require a gradual series of changes, and needs will evolve.
Right, and for example, as sea levels increase, communities could agree on indicators of certain levels that would trigger the construction of certain protective barriers. But communities wouldn't just build all protective barriers all at once, because predictions evolve and sea level rise numbers will change. For example, today we know that sea level is predicted to rise at much higher levels than previously predicted, thus rendering certain protective barriers useless.
So, different barriers and adaptive measures would be built gradually where necessary.
And as sea level rise and flooding frequency increases to a certain risky point, communities could agree upon certain levels that would symbolize it's time to change actions from adaptive to migrant.
The only problem is that this type of planning relies on the cooperation of future politicians and voters in implementing these actions. And we already mentioned the difficulties in engaging an efficient politician.
Debaters agreed that in order to overcome this inefficiency, citizens and economic interests should focus on medium-term adaptive planning, in which the impacts of a changing climate are considered in economic development, local development, flood/wind insurance, and disaster assistance plans.
But beyond adaptive strategies, there is a need to address the human-caused conditions that contribute to climate change. While adaptation policies are considered primarily the responsibility of state and local governments, reduction of greenhouse gases is considered a federal responsibility.
In addition to regulations and penalties, government action needs to include incentives that reward socially desirable behavior.
Speaking of socially desirable behavior, these two socialites and I very much desire your input.
Oh no, this term is going to stick with you, isn't it?
Hey, I personally think it's one of my best yet.
At least it's not about Harry Potter.
Oh, don't you worry, I've got some serious ones I might be able to slither into our next episode.
Wow. All right. Before Daniela explodes, let's wrap this up, shall we? As Aubrey said, we're looking forward to your comments on social media and seeing what you thought of today's episode.
Should vulnerable communities be relocated? If so, how long will it take for populations to accept a move?
Or should we continue protecting our coasts and increasing resiliency? Where's the balance?
Tweet us your thoughts using the hashtag ISGPForum, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at ISGPForum.
And don't forget to like us on Facebook as well.
Thanks for joining us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy today. Hope you enjoyed socializing with us and with science.
We'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.